Welcome to the Break the Mold Parking Podcast with myself, Ryan Jackson.
And me, Alistair Finlayson.
And in each episode, we'll be discussing the very latest in parking news and industry insights,
as well as cutting-edge business and thought leadership topics.
Welcome back to another episode of Break the Mold, the Parking Podcast. Today, we are joined by a man who needs no introduction, but he's going to get one anyway. He's been with the BPA for 10 years, oversaw the launch of Poplar, as well as playing a vital role in developing the code of practice for parking on private land, the one and only Mr. Steve Clark. Steve, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's great to be here.
No problem. Welcome to the show, Steve. You know, unfortunately, we didn't get to have you in person because of COVID-19 and the situation that's going on at the moment. But I suppose it really... poses the first question, and you know how would this affect the parking industry? What do you think the consequences of COVID-19 are going to be on the private parking industry as a whole?
I think they're already being very marked on the grounds of hearing reports of 95% declines in terms of PCNs being issued. Mm-hmm. And I think that's going to be causing us problems as we go on, without a shadow of doubt. I'm also alert to the fact that a number of our operators have furloughed a lot of their staff at the moment, which I think has made a difference. It certainly, that sort of sensible management will help them with their future cash flows and whatever. But of course, they still need to keep a number of people around to enable all the requirements that are there in terms of appeals, use of Poplar, etc., are in place that enables them to actually function as a business. We're not hearing, as of yet, any significantly sad stories about any of our members. No one's actually had to close the door as of yet, but I think that sadly we might hear some of those stories. At the association, we're trying to do all that we can to help those people, to try and keep them engaged in whatever way, shape or form that we can. For example, in terms of membership fees, we're certainly happy to listen to any suggestions from members about deferring payments for a couple of months from when they would normally be due to see people through this time. Another option is we might look at some sort of payment plan to pay the fees in installments. I think that's quite important. You know, silence is no good in this area. You know, one of the things I've been doing, or two of the things I've been doing. First one is I have probably individually spoken to at least half of the membership of the approved operator scheme in the month of April. And I'll try and speak to the other half in the month of May if I can. Secondly, any email queries or inquiries or questions, no matter how daft, I'm trying to answer them the same day. So you're getting good turnaround and people know that we're still there. I've got to be honest with you. Very often people have been saying, well, great to get such a great, you know, quick response. Really appreciate it, Steve. That's positive. And that's the sort of thing we should be doing. And having that situation of also just making sure, because as Alistair said at the start, I've been in this job for 10 years. A lot of the people I deal with, I've worked with for 10 years. So, of course, when I'm talking to them, I will be asking them how their families are. I will be asking them how their business is. We can talk about all sorts of things. I know what football teams some of them support, etc. Not that there's much of that going on at the moment. But, and all of that's quite important, I think, to just push that forward. I'm always happy to ask the questions. Anything else we can do? Although I am probably struggling a bit to deal with the request I got last week was to find a cure for COVID-19 because strangely enough, I haven't become an eminent virologist yet. Although, you know, you never know.
It's never too late, Steve. And so, from what you know, do you know if COVID-19 itself is going to affect the parking code that's going to come into play?
I think it will affect the timing. I think it has to affect the timing. However, as things stand at the moment, the government intentions are to start the process in May and June with some consult, with some work with some key stakeholders, myself included, to try and draft what a single code could look like. And then during June and the summer months, the intention would be to go out to full public consultation on that. And then in the autumn, notionally, so I guess September onwards, that same group would reconvene to look at the consultation responses. That's the plan as we see it in terms of working with government. I think that there it has to be a good chance that that might get deferred in some way, shape or form, where civil servants have to prioritise dealing with COVID-19 matters. And you can't blame them for that. And, you know, we're dealing with the Ministry for Housing, Communities and Local Government. They will have far more pressing things to deal with than this code. But that doesn't mean it all grinds to a stop. It just means it might get deferred for a bit, which means we might be looking at something happening into 2021. They were pretty much clear they wanted it finished by the end of Q1 2021. It might just be moved back a few months. It rather depends, of course, on how COVID-19 develops over the next few months and how long we are in lockdown for and how much additional work government officials have to do. But they will be prioritising COVID-19 and you can't really blame them for that.
Yeah, of course. And, you know, it does throw a few spanners in the works in terms of timescales and what the parking code is going to look like and how life in the park industry is going to be once it comes to fruition. But what is it at the moment that we know for certain that is in black and white, this is how it's going to look at this stage, being it very early in the scope of things?
Yeah, we've got two certainties and an almost absolute certainty. So that's a fantastic phrase to use. So the two certainties, first and foremost, are that there will be what's called a standard setting body. So that will be a body that both of the existing ATAs, which is ourselves at the BPA and the IPC, would notionally report to. Okay, so that body would be in place to set the standard. The second certainty is that there will be a single code of practice for all parking operators, irrespective of which ATA they belong to comply with, to meet the standards of, etc. The third almost absolute certainty, which is obviously a strange phrase, but it does say in the Act that if the code requires it, there will be a single independent appeal service. So as things stand at the moment, that third strand can't be met. I am pretty certain that there will be a single independent appeal service. There are currently two, Poplar, which you'll be fully aware of, and also the IPC run their independent appeal service as well. So there's two out there. I am 99.9% certain that there will be only one when this comes to play.
So obviously from that, we've got sort of the IPC, we've got the BPA, and then there's essentially going to be one body above those two. Can you see there being any form of merger between the IPC and BPA, given that for the parking operator standpoint, you're then starting to get a bit of a complex pyramid forming of governing bodies and ATAs sort of above an operator?
I think first and foremost, the best thing that ever happened to parking operators in the UK was the arrival of the IPC, because all of a sudden there was competition, and competition breeds two organisations who are looking to do the best for their members, to attract members from the other side. So the best thing that ever happened was the arrival of the IPC. If you're a private parking operator, speaking personally, I also think it's a good thing. As far as I'm concerned, I think it's a good thing as well. I like competition. I've worked in competitive environments all my life, and I feel that I'm doing a much better job if I've got something to compete against. Back in the day, I was a fairly competitive midfield footballer. I'm not suggesting for a second that I'm going to be doing any tackles on IPC staff, but you know, it's nice to have an edge. It's nice to have a focus. It's nice to have something to work against. I don't necessarily see a merger between the respective ATAs at all. I see a situation where both of us will be required to meet the same standards as set by the standard setting body. I think it's also worth noting, I believe, and I've got nothing to back this, but it's what I would do if I was government, that the independent appeal service, the single independent appeal service, would also report to the standard setting body. So you can imagine there'd be a three-pronged approach there. I think that the standard setting body should be doing just that, set the standard. I don't believe they should be getting involved in the minutiae. That is not going to help anybody. All that's going to happen is we'll spend half our life reporting on the minutiae, and none of the three bodies working for the standard setting body will be able to work on raising standards, which should be what we're here to do as a trade body at the BPA, a trade body at the IPC, and an appeal service at whatever the new appeal service is called.
And so do you feel that there has been a raise in standards since the ISPC's come into play?
Yeah, in terms of customer service, there has been a raising of standards. I'm a lot more responsive now than I probably was 6 or 7 years ago, in terms of making sure that the members that I've got that remain 116 AOS members pretty much know where they can go if they want some help and advice. Because the last thing I want is them deciding to jump ship and go to the other organisation. The other side of that is, of course, it gives me the opportunity for those people who are with the other organisation to pick up the phone and do a bit of cold calling, a bit of hard selling, or whatever phrase you want to use, a bit of canvassing. And that takes me back to the halcyon days of when I was flogging advertising space up the high streets of Reading. So, you know, when I was a young man with all my hair and my own teeth. So it has to be good. Competition is good. There are you know, our members are all in competition. Their pencils have to be sharper. Their customer service has to be tighter. Their proactivity and their reactivity has to be so much better. It's got to be a good thing. In terms of standards themselves, I don't believe there were people saying that the arrival of a second ATA might see a race to the bottom, in that the codes would actually get weaker because the codes would notionally be competing with each other. There is no evidence to support that. We've worked very hard to develop the approved operator scheme code. No doubt about that. I've been heavily involved in that, all of that, all the way through. And to their credit, the IPC have worked hard on developing their code. And if you're as dull and tedious as me, and you're a student of both codes, as I am, I can safely tell you there aren't a lot of differences between them. If anything, the BPA code is slightly more motorist friendly. The IPC code slightly more operator friendly, but it's negligible. I can safely tell you there are clauses that have been written in the IPC code, which I have shamelessly copied across into the BPA code. And I'm sure that if you ask Will the same question, he would say the same thing. Because sometimes you see something you want to include in the code of practice because it's the right thing to do. And you can't think about wording it any better than the other person has done it.
Yeah, you know, that makes absolute sense. But can you see the new code coming into play being sort of causing operators to do things majorly different? Because obviously the code at the moment is all about sort of setting high standards and doing the right thing and best practice. So if the industry on the whole is already doing that, us as parking operators, are we actually going to have to change our methods of practice that drastically?
I don't believe you're going to have to change the methods of practice that drastically. I think there's a number of uncertainties about what changes might be put afoot, and we should probably try and deal with some of these in the conversation. There will be lengthy debate about the maximum amount of the parking charge, which is currently at £100, reduced to £60. We absolutely at the BPA believe that should continue to be the sum. There has to be an adequate deterrent, and we'll be defending that position stoically.
It'd be interesting to see what happens with that, given that some London authorities, I believe my local authority, the London Borough of Haven, I think is £140, penalty charge notice amount. So it's interesting to see how, although they are different entities, how the amounts are different, given that they're one of the same almost.
Yeah, there is a range of differences across the whole of the UK. So the £140 you allude to there is probably the on-street amount for Havering. So it's not an off-street amount. The off-street amount for Havering cancelled tickets is likely to be less than £100. It'll be different from the on-street amount. It's also worth noting that outside of London, the amounts for on-street and off-street are significantly lower than the number you've argued there. I think what we have to understand is there has to be an adequate deterrent to stop motorists, to make sure that motorists pay where they should and shouldn't park in places where they're not permitted to do so. Okay, it's as simple as that. There has to be a deterrent. There has to be a reason to stop people chancing their arm in whatever way, shape or form that might be. And that has to be the case. And we will be working on that to the best interests of our members. I think it should be identified, of course, there would be people on the other side, the anti-parking lobby, whatever it might be, believe that they want to see that sum reduced, and they believe in reducing that sum, they may have gained some sort of victory. Probably not, because I think we have to understand there's a reason why there are parking enforcement regimes in place. And a number of those reasons are, let's take a good example. in Haywards Heath, where our office is, there is a Sainsbury's right next to the railway station. If there weren't parking restrictions there, with a parking charge notice as a deterrent against people not following those restrictions, that car park at Sainsbury's would be full of people getting on the train to go to London. If, at that point, you've turned up to do your shopping in that Sainsbury's outlet and you can't find a space, you don't go to Sainsbury's, you go somewhere else. It's as simple as that. Similarly, if you are a resident of a housing association in London that happens to be very close to a tube station, you will find a lot of people unable to leave their homes during the so-called rush hour because people are parking on their drives, people are parking on the parking space that's allocated to their homes. Without a deterrent in place, that can't happen. And these are the sort of things that happen where there are no adequate deterrents in place. So it is very, very important that the amount of the parking charge is kept at the very least the existing levels to make sure that people's behaviours don't go in the opposite direction. An awful lot of work has been done to make sure people, as I said, pay where they should and don't park where they shouldn't. And that should that has to continue. Selfish parking is exactly that, selfish.
Yeah, and you know, I'm in complete agreement with that. And actually, might sound a bit controversial, but I'm all for in favour of parking charges being in line, both private and public, because there's so much confusing information out there for the general motoring public, whether it's private land, council land, seeing, you know, things becoming a bit more level and the same rules apply and the same processes applying, I think just makes the whole parking industry, private or public, you know, a lot more transparent and clearer for the parker.
Absolutely. But I think the theory is absolutely spot on. No one's going to argue with the theory. Unfortunately, this is the point where you get some dull harbinger like me banging on about how the practicalities are going to make that very difficult. I think we have to understand that local authorities are issuing their penalty charge notices under statutory legislation. Our members, our private parking operators, are basically using the principles of the law of contract to issue parking charge notices. Mm. There's a huge difference between the two. And I think there would be a lot of work to be done to try and bring the theory that you've spoken about into line. I completely agree with the theory. It's the dull and tedious people like me that can find the practical ways of not bringing it to fruition.
We spoke about, you spoke about a parking charge notice being, you know, a secondary measure after management, and it just be as a consequence of people parking selfishly. In relation to the code of compliance, now the compliance creates a set standard to which operators must abide to, but do you think there's anything that the BPA or the IPC could do to encourage operators to go above and beyond?
We do that now. We are encouraging operators, both of the approved accredited trade associations will be encouraging operators to go above and beyond wherever way, shape or form they can. Of course, there's a difference between guidance to encourage raising standards and raising the bar and actually mandating those in a code of practice. I'll give you a for instance. At the moment, we are encouraging our ANPR operators to undertake the Camera Commissioner's Code of Practice and to get accredited through that code of practice. What we're not doing at the moment is making that a mandatory requirement, because what we want to do is get to a situation where the operators themselves who want to have a try at this and to gain this additional accreditation are doing it on a voluntary basis, can therefore take their time. And then if it gets to the point where we find this is a successful situation and that people have benefited from that, we may at some stage in the future mandate that situation. And so there's a difference between raising standards through suggesting voluntary codes and affiliations with other areas and then mandating that later.
That does make perfect sense to me, because obviously if you then say, you know, from this date, everyone has to have this accreditation, the accrediting body aren't going to be able to handle the demand of just everyone all of a sudden bombarding them. Whereas if it's suggested and recommended, it sort of staggers, that makes it easier for them.
It's a bit like ICO, for example, 9001. The fact that a lot of organisations, they acquire that accreditation, but they don't necessarily adopt the practices involved with it. At the point whereby they have an audit, then they'll go and, you know, complete the necessary paperwork to meet the needs of that particular audit or assessment, but it doesn't become a part of the operational process. So could that be the same with just other accreditations? Do we need to be doing more to encourage that correct behaviour from operators for them to want to be able to deliver a service that puts the motorists at the forefront of their from their viewpoint, as opposed to just looking at them as a means of income generation?
Last year, because I'm not going to say what we might do this year now, but last year we handled about 6,500 motorist inquiries, okay, in some way, shape or form. And about a quarter of those ended up with us opening formal investigations into what the motorist was alleging. Every single one of those inquiries is an opportunity for an operator to learn and to improve what they do. Some of them are very, very straightforward. Some of them more complex and the learning is more difficult. But every single one of those is a learning opportunity. Secondly, we conduct 1,000 ad hoc visits to car parks by our qualified auditors, our area managers, who inspect car parks at random. So no one ever knows where they're going to show up next. And they basically, we will then assess the car park based on a red, amber, green situation. So if you've got a green car park, happy days, you get a nice little note that says, "Dear operator, this car park's green, keep up the good work." Amber. Amber is something where there's a few minor improvements that could be made. The simplest one to explain is probably if there's foliage covering the signs. Under the law of contract, you've got a load of bushes covering a sign, the sign doesn't work. So the minor putting that right is to actually cut back the foliage. And so very often we've got the senior member of one of our major operators popping out with his secateurs, always amuses me that one, and gets them out to make that right. And of course, you've got the red. The red is quite straightforward. Nowhere near meeting the standards of the BPA's approved operator scheme. And we would require that until the operator puts right what they've done or what they should be doing at that location, they should not be making requests for DVLA data and or issuing PCNs at that location. Good news is we didn't have any red audits last year, which is fantastic. We had a few ambers. We'll always get ambers because of the things I've spoken about. But the majority, I think it was about 84%, were green audits. They passed muster. The other one just to have in the background as well is the arrival of Poplar. The arrival of Poplar has made a significant difference to the way that operators function. If we take ourselves back to the pre-Poplar days, the operators' appeals services were on the whole not great because there was no financial obligation on the operator. The operator could reject the appeal for spurious reasons and not really worry about it. And we're going back, what, 7 years now, 7, 8 years. So that was the situation we found ourselves in back in those days. Not perfect. If you reject an appeal now, you run the risk of the case going to Poplar. In running the risk of the case going to Poplar, you run the risk of being told you've got to cancel the ticket and you have to pay a fee for the privilege. There has been a marked and startling improvement in the quality of the operators' first-line appeal services that they offer. And that will only improve and continue as we go on. So in terms of raising the standards, I think those three actions are really quite important in doing exactly what you've spoken about.
Mm-hmm. I have a question for you, and I think it's only fair because we did pose the question to John from Poplar. And so what has come out as a result of the Poplar report is that there is still quite a considerable amount of the bigger operators, it seems, that are withdrawing a high case of numbers. So do you think the industry would benefit from there being a cap on how many withdrawals can be made?
There is a definite cap on how many withdrawals that can be made. Anyone withdrawing more than 25% will have the opportunity of a conversation with me. What I would also say is that I've removed that lid for this period of COVID-19. Our operators have got other things to do, more important to the running of their business, of being worried about there might be some lid on the level of Poplar withdrawals. I think it's also important to note that Poplar and the BPA combined have taken the decision to adjourn Poplar cases as of the 6th of April, because neither party, the motorist or the operator, can probably put together a tangible evidence pack that they would be proud of. the motorist, for example, would be unable to pop along to a site just to see if there was signage there. And likewise, with operators furloughing staff, they may not have a situation where they have sufficient people to deal with the popular appeals and would be dealing with the first line appeals. So adjourning the popular appeals is exactly the right thing to do. And secondly, just removing that cap for now.
But do you think still, given the fact that the sum operator is issuing, you know, over 100,000 PCNs on an annual basis, do you think 25% is still a considerable number? And do you think there needs to be greater consequence than perhaps a phone conversation from yourself?
I think a phone conversation with me is you know, without going formal, is as tough as it gets. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, if I'm absolutely honest with you, but I will go formal if they don't change behaviours, and we can go formal. We have sanctions. We have the ability to issue sanctions if we have to on that. I think if you read the Popper annual report, John will allude to this. We have worked together on the constant reduction of those popular withdrawals. I think it's also worth understanding another couple of factors. In terms of the hundreds of thousands of PCNs issued each year in the UK, 0.89% of those, so less than 1% of them, end up at Poplar. Okay, so in effect, if we're allowing people to withdraw 25% of the 0.89, that's going to be in the region of 0.22, which is less than a quarter of a percent of the whole tickets issued in the country can be withdrawn at Poplar. It's also worth noting there will be good reasons why cases should be withdrawn. Okay, a couple of ones which really do stick out for me. First one is, you get a motorist who appeals first line. Okay, motorist appeals first line and gives some spurious reason why they're appealing it. They then get their Poplar code and they then give raft of additional information that, if the operator had known at the first line of appeal, would have cancelled that. And that includes mitigation. So all of a sudden, when they've got to Poplar, they're talking about all of the mitigation. They could have a disability. They could have been delayed for whatever reason it might be. We're quite happy for motorists to relook at a case that's gone and gone, well, if I'd known that at the start, I would have moved it along. You know, I would have cancelled it at the first stage. The other one is where the landowner actually says, actually, no, I want you to cancel this ticket. So the operator has already cancelled the ticket by the time it gets through the Poplar process. Therefore, they withdraw the case at no charge because that makes economic sense. So, yeah, absolutely. Last point on this one, in terms of what happens in the local authority sector, it's about 33%. Of no contests, i.e. the local authority withdraws. Okay, so it's a third. So that figure is actually higher. And don't forget as well, lastly on this one, if an operator withdraws the case, the PCN has to be cancelled if it has not already been done so. Okay, it isn't we can withdraw from Poplar and then pursue it. And if they pursue a withdrawn case, that is a clear and sanctionable breach of the code of practice. And they won't be getting a phone call from me. They'll be getting a letter. We have expelled, I think it's 9 AOS members in the 10 years I've been with the association. Okay. That's not decisions we take lightly and at all under any circumstances. There is a huge bit of me that says, if I expel a member, you know, it is me. I end up doing the work that leads to the reports that enables the various parts of the BPA that actually take these decisions, but I'm the one who compiles the reports. If we have to do that, I think we failed, because we failed to work with that operator to raise standards to improve what's going on. We have definitely failed. So every one of those 9 instances is a failure to all intents and purposes. But also an important thing to remember when you're talking to compliant operators. So what an operator who wouldn't consider half of the things that people, or any of the things that people have been expelled for, you get into a nuts and bolts conversation, operator might say, well, why should I bother complying? I can then explain that. And of course, they're all of a sudden, they go, you know what? I'm really pleased that you've actually taken those tough actions, because it actually vindicates the fact that I work incredibly hard and invest a lot of time and money in complying.
Our vision is very much about improving the overall reputation of the industry and trying to be the change in within it. And so, you know, we've highlighted areas whereby we think, okay, we can make improvements here, or we see things which doesn't really make sense, or they do seem questionable. And going back to obviously the popular reporting information, from what we can see, there are still a number of operators who are when you compare them to the vast majority, are still making, you know, their withdrawal rates are considerably higher. So for us, that just, maybe we, you know, it's guilty to proven innocent, but it's, you know, it does question the intent of the operators, and are they just simply, you know, cancelling at the point or making withdrawals at the point of Poplar rather than doing the correct provisions in the initial appeal stage?
It's a perfectly viable question, and I can safely tell you that there were two operators specifically, quite large operators, who were probably doing exactly that. I'm not going to say who they are, but I can certainly tell you that I was in their offices face to face telling them how they needed to change and what the implications of not changing would be.
It's actually really positive to sort of hear that you are having these conversations, because it's not something that we would really know about unless we were having this conversation now. We would have, obviously, it's stuff which happens behind closed doors and you don't air your dirty laundry, et cetera, et cetera. But I think this is a positive message to send out to the industry that, look, Poplar's there to offer the motorists a second chance if they feel hard done by the parking operator. And it's not there to be sort of used by the parking operator to just hit reject on every single appeal and then wait for it to get to Poplar and go, oh, well, we tried, we didn't get our money, let's just withdraw now. So it's good to hear that action is being taken to stop people gaming the system and making sure Poplar's being used for its correct purpose.
I totally agree with what you said. You know, and this will continue. We monitor this all the time. I've got that caveat in that I have relaxed the rules during this period of COVID-19 because I think it's the right, hand on heart, I think it's the right thing to do.
Completely.
The moment we come out of this, the rules go back on. And one of my team monitor this on a monthly basis. So we know exactly who might be bucking the system. I'd also point out, by the way, there will be specific incidents where if an operator has got a problem, maybe a small operator who's only got one person handling the Poplar appeals, and that person has a long-term illness and whatever, I might, if we have a chat about it, we might have a situation where, you know what, I'd allow them to withdraw everything for a couple of months because they've given a good reason, but more importantly, because they've come and spoken to us up front. I think what's very interesting, of course, where you've got a situation like an organisation like Gemini, you won't be aware of some of these things because they just don't happen to you because you comply. And I had a conversation with another operator in a very similar position the other month. I went up to see him at his offices. He wanted to ask me a number of searching questions, as you are doing here. And I made the point exactly to him. And all the light bulbs came on. I didn't know you did that. And I looked across at his compliance manager and I said, well, the reason we don't do it for you is her. And of course she was quite pleased by that referral. But it's absolutely spot on. If you are a compliant operator and you do what all the things we ask you to do, and all of your audits are green and all your mystery shoppers are green and your complaints come back and you take the appropriate rectification and you hold your hands up when you made a mistake, you're never going to have a problem with us. There'll be a number of operators in that position who actually aren't on my radar at all. There are operators on my radar, I can tell you now, and they'll be on there for some considerable time. Gemini are not on the radar for me, which is a good place for you to be.
thank you.
I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm confident in saying there's very few operators on your radar, and there might be some operators that were in a similar position to us where you sort of sit there thinking, well, we're sort of trying to do the right thing, best practice, be honest, you know, try and change that public perception. And you could sit there thinking, well, we could make a lot more revenue if we started gaming the system or, you know, bending the rules slightly. So it's good to hear that it does get noticed, and that I'm sure the majority of the industry, both IPC members and BPA members, are in the same boat as us and just wanting to do the right thing. Because at the end of the day, we're all human. We all want to sleep at night with a clean conscience by, you know, doing best practice and following the rules.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, you've got a situation where the IPC have got an independent appeal service. So the same thing that I talked about with Poplar in terms of raising the standards of the first line of appeal will have applied at the IPC. I think actually they arrived with an independent appeal service as well. I think we had Poplar in place before the IPC was formed. So to a certain extent, they never saw the benefit of the improvement in those standards. But I can tell you, it was incredibly marked. The arrival of Poplar in terms of the quality of the first line appeals. And I can understand why. Because of course it does relate to money, because if the operational side of things or the first line appeals department isn't doing their job properly, and the owner of the business is forking out additional £26.50 per appeal fees where they don't need to because they could have put it right first time, you can understand why that would be the case.
An idea that we've thrown about the office for some time now, and I think it's something that we put to Steve Rees in one of the earlier shows, is do you feel that the industry or the end user would benefit if there was some form of a league table as a result of the audit that were held by the BPA? Do you think that would go some way to encourage, better behaviour from operators and push them to want to be better and not to be at the bottom of sat at that table?
I think the theory again is sound. It's very, very sound indeed. I think it's quite interesting. There's always a nice cacophony when the Poplar League tables come out. I was able to tell a small operator that had the best success rate that he had the best success rate, and I sent him a little clip art of a trophy. I couldn't send him a real one, unfortunately, but I sent a little clip art which amused him and made him feel pretty good. I think the challenge is we don't numerically issue the results of the audit. They're either green, amber, or red. From that point of view,
that the BPA could potentially do
To basically say if someone to actually put out there that someone's had a red audit, would be reluctant.
Or process it numerically as opposed to the amber, green, and or red, green and amber?
I think that it's something we could definitely look at if we weren't going into a situation where there was going to be a new world of new code of practice and new auditing protocols. I think one of the things that, making changes now will impact on operators. So I think it's very, very important that we don't make changes for change's sake now. You may notice, I'm sorry, there's all sorts of things going on in my world. I hope that's not impinging on the sound quality.
Oh, you're okay.
Yeah, it's just everything's bouncing in at the moment. Let me just get rid of that.
The joys of working from home, mate.
I've got to be honest with you. It's the DVLA have just sent me something, okay? And also, we've been doing some work with the RAC about standards as well. So actually, both of those things have just come in, which is pretty good news. So I'm quite pleased about that in terms of you get a little hint of what the message is about, and they've both been quite positive. And I've completely lost the track of where I was. If we go back to not wanting to make changes for change's sake in these difficult times, the operators are likely to face challenges. If you look at the code changes we made at the back end of last year, coming on for relaunch in the latest iteration, we did not make changes for change's sake. We just made changes or clarifications that needed to be made. And in the back of our minds, and this is the various boards who represent members, because as a membership association, I report to a board that's got members on it. We took decisions that had to, A, would be raising standards, but at the same token would not be put in place just for the sake of it to put burden on operators. Now, I'll give you, for instance, we spent a lot of time and we introduced clause 17.4 of the code, which relates to what to do with keying errors. Okay, a lot of time was spent with that. That had to be done. There's no doubt in my mind that would raise standards. And I think there was a possibility there was a burden on our members there by introducing those clauses. But there wouldn't be any additional charges in terms of redoing signage, redoing notices, redoing paperwork. So all of those things had to be balanced up from that point of view. Obviously, we would always require if people had to key in a registration that it said on the signage, they should be doing that anyway. That wouldn't have been a change. But actually how to deal with a keying error complaint was the right way to go. And I'd have to say it has probably been the item that we have got the most positive news coverage on in the last 5 years, the work that we did there. For once in my life, I was actually, heralded by the Mail. I don't think it'll happen again for 5 years, but we won't worry about it. But at the end of the day, it was the right thing to do. And it was well received by everybody, because if you take the keying error situation, the motorist has paid for parking, no doubt. okay? But they haven't done it properly. They've made a mistake, and we're allowed to make mistakes, and we've worked a protocol together that enables mistakes to be looked after and dealt with appropriately. We're not in mistake punishment. We're in car park management, and we have to remember that. So that change was made to the code to raise standards, but not putting a burden on operators at the same time in terms of additional outlay on materials. And that would be pretty much my way of thinking between now and whenever the single code comes into play. If we had to make changes to the code of practice because something happened, we would make those, but we'd against that be looking at ways of making sure we mitigated against causing financial burden to members.
And that's actually sort of quite an interesting point, given if we sort of look back to when GDPR came into play,
yep.
There was significant changes that operators had to do, signage, sort of PCN notices, et cetera, et cetera. And this wasn't just a BPO thing, it was IPC as well. It seemed to be a bit of an industry-wide problem where everyone was running around like headless chickens because no one really knew what it was going to look like. And one of the sort of recurring comments made was, whenever we're asking our governing body for help, we're just referred to seek legal consultation, whatever the IPC's version of BPA law line is, if they have one, JBW legal, et cetera, et cetera. So it's quite a sort of financial burden on operators. And I imagine for some of the smaller players in the industry, it was really difficult times for them. Given that we've got a new code coming into play, and given the financial struggles with the current COVID situation, what assurances could the BPA give to their members of help and guidance in terms of saving them costs on legal expenses when it comes to wording notices, what they need to do for signage, etc.?
In terms of the GDPR situation, let's be absolutely clear. We didn't invent that one, without a shadow of doubt.
Yeah.
We did quite a lot of work pro bono in there. We had 5 seminars for operators. It's also worth noting, I know for a fact that I dealt with an awful lot of individual inquiries from operators and members in terms of trying to advise them to the best of my ability. Mm. We did produce items and literature for operators to use and to consider, and they were produced for us by BPA Lawline, or as we rebadged it, BPA GDPR Line, because the marketing boys spent a lot of money on that. But I do take on board that there were some very, very complex questions that we had to refer people to get the legal answers on, because we weren't qualified to answer them ourselves. I answered a lot of questions, and I've got to be honest with you, I'm still answering questions on that very subject now. I'd also point out that my answers now are a darn sight better. Where are we? What? Best part of 2 years on from GDPR, yeah. Because I have learned an awful lot myself during that period. And it was the practical implications of GDPR. So, I'm absolutely aware that some operators had to get specific advice themselves on specific complex questions. I personally believe we did give a lot of support of a general nature to operators. Absolutely. Moving on to the second part of the question, which is about what's going to happen with the Private Parking Act. I think there are 2 strands here. Okay. The first strand is actually what we're doing now. Okay. What we're doing now is we've engaged a guy called Steve Thompson as a consultant to work with us. Steve is a BPA council member. He's worked for local authorities. He was working for the Marston Group for a while. He left there. He's now been engaged with us now on a consultancy basis for the next 6 months to be the focal point for our efforts in assisting operators through the initial parts of this process. And by the initial parts of this process, I mean talking to people about what's going on in terms of the process I spoke about right at the start of this call, giving advice and guidance through the consultation period for the Code of Practice Act. Because one thing is very, very certain. If operators leave the consultation response to me and to Will Hurley, it will not be enough, not by a long chalk. And the reason I'm saying that is the other side, the anti-parking lobby, will be all over this in spades, and their consultation responses will be voluminous. There'll be loads of them. And we've got to make sure that we're equally voluminous and equal quality. And Steve will be leading the charge on that. And I can tell you now, Steve will be making contact with your organisation in the near future. He's doing some work at the moment. We're putting a questionnaire together for all operators to answer. That'll be going out sometime next week. Operators can answer that questionnaire. Just to give a handle of where people are. I spoke at some length on this at the AOS conference in terms of encouraging operators to make sure that they are lobbying as well. So lobbying your MP is important. Being involved in the consultation process. As an adjunct to that lobbying, of course, you will have the situation where we need to get your landowners doing the same thing. Because what will be really, really powerful in our lobbying on behalf of the parking sector will be feedback from landowners over the importance of deterrent. And those landowners will range from the chief executive of Sainsbury's, the chief executive of British Land, the people who run the train operating companies in the UK. They'll also run to housing associations, may also run to individual residents who need to have their parking space that's next to their house managed by their private parking operator. And if they don't, some urban will park in there and they can't use their own parking space. It's the whole range of that. And so that's very, very important to make those points. It is really important that the deterrent to stop people doing the wrong thing is in place. And that's why we will be engaging that work. We're also working with BPA Lawline, of course, and spending a not inconsiderable sum of money with Derek. Not as much as Derek would like, of course, but then he's a lawyer. But it's certainly a not inconsiderable sum. Plus, I'm working on it too. And we've got great relationships with Parliament. I will be sitting on the group that forms the code of practice. Okay, I will be having my say in that room, and that say on behalf of our membership. We are hoping that we can get a practitioner, a leading operator, to join us in the room, because that's going to be quite important as well. And we're also hoping that MHCLG will allow us to get a landowner in the room too. They haven't confirmed that yet. We're lobbying on that position. So I think those things are very important. When the code starts to come fruition, of course, we're in a position to assist people with wording on these things, because we will have been right involved in the inception of what it's going to say.
I'm sure that's music to a lot of operators' ears.
And one hopes it is, because, but and of course, this is...
Asking, would we have to pay for that privilege, or would it be something...
Ryan, you already pay for that privilege
for that privilege.
No, I'm not going to charge you extra for my advice at all, Ryan. There's no problem at all. But you wouldn't want to pay my hourly rate anyway. No, in all seriousness, we will do the best we can to make sure that specific questions are answered. Okay. At the moment, in terms of this COVID-19 thing, as I said earlier on, someone sends me a query, I'm trying to turn it around that day. If I can't turn it around because it's too complex, they get an acknowledgement that day to say, I'm thinking about it. And obviously, they have to understand it's quite complex. One of our biggest operators sent me a document to review last week. It was complex, but it's been done. And that's what we do. The reason we can do that better than we may have been able to do with GDPR is we understand the parking sector better than we understood GDPR. I was learning as I was going to a certain extent in that period. Hand on heart, I think I did the best job I could. I know I can do a better job with this code.
Yes, I guess the takeaway point from that is with GDPR, operators may have struggled to sort of get the help that they necessarily needed if it was more of an advanced question, just given to the fact that you've got no involvement with it. Whereas with the parking code, given the lobbying that private operators can do, landowners can do, the work that you're doing, you're shaping it almost and moulding where it's going. So then you're going to be the person to go to get that help and guidance when it comes to, you know, what changes do we need to make to our letters? What changes do we need to make to signage? How long have we got to implement these changes? Because surely it's not going to be an overnight process.
Well, again, let's just try and deal with those three points that you've made there. So in terms of shaping it, yes, I'll be in the room trying to shape it to the best of my ability. Will Hurley will be in the room trying to shape it to the best of his ability. We'll probably sit next to each other and jointly try and shape it to the best of our respective abilities. Okay, without a shadow of a doubt. I think it's also worth pointing out, though, there will be other people in the room who've got their own agenda as well, and they'll be looking to shape things too. But we'll have an understanding of the sort of things we're going to have to do. If we go to look at changes that need to be made for signage and for notices, can be handled slightly separately. Notices, there are two issues with notices. First and foremost, the content of them. And then, of course, the processing, the computer processing that goes behind the issuing of them. Because, of course, that is probably more complicated than making a change to actually what something looks like. But that has to be done. There will be a cost to that. It will take time.
Am I right in thinking that PCNs are going to be renamed under the new code?
I think that is something that could happen. There is a move afoot from what I would call the other side to change the name of the parking charge notice, the PCN, to something else. The favoured one at the moment is private parking notice, so that would be PPN. Okay. People are concerned that there is confusion between the statutory penalty charge notice, PCN, and our non-statutory parking charge notice, PCN. They're also concerned that sometimes we design our notices to look like what people would get from a local authority. Well, actually, I think our notices are a vast improvement on what you might get from a local authority. They're more informative. There's a lot more detail in them. They look official. Well, actually, they're official documents. You know, people say, oh, they're an invoice and all that sort of thing. Well, actually, they are. In all intents and purposes, they are an invoice in respect of liquidated damages of a breach of a parking contract. Therefore, they need to have certain things in there that make them comply with the code of practice and that give them the very small O official status. If we go back to the, so the changes to notices, changes to signage will take time. There are hundreds of thousands of signs in the UK. Okay. We want to make sure two things. First and foremost, that we only have to make one change. Right. So everything stacked up, operators only have to change their signs if they have to change them once. Secondly, we want to make sure there is a grandfather period, a period to enable that to happen. My view is that period should be years rather than months. Okay. But there has to be an understanding that if Gemini Parking take over a new site in July 2021, you can't put your old signs up. You'd have to put new signs up. That's got to be clear. We'd also probably think it sensible for a parking operator to look at where they issue the most PCNs and have those signs or the changes to those signs further up the list for changing to enable there to be fewer complaints from motorists going, the sign in the car park doesn't comply with the new code of practice 2021. Well, yeah, we know it doesn't because there's a grandfather period and we'd be saying that for some considerable time. So if you're issuing lots of PCNs at a location in Welwyn Garden City, get that high up your list of where you're going to change the signs. Where you're not issuing so many PCNs or where you've just got enforcement going, where they're just having signs for enforcement, they can wait a lot longer. But we'll be pushing for years rather than months. And I'd also have to say that Rishi Sunak, who was the minister at the time of the inception of the whole of this, he was in charge, he was the minister at MHCLG, and Rishi was absolutely on board with that point. He absolutely understood that point. And the guys and the civil servants who are there now and still there absolutely understand that point. It's a matter of us to be on our negotiating metal.
Is there anything else private operators should be doing? And, you know, sort of a two-part question, I guess, as well. When it comes to the lobbying, is there any, templates, but is there any documents you can hand out to people where they can use that as a template to send to their local MP? Because some people might not be familiar with having to lobby before and how to word it, etc.
Absolutely. One of Steve's jobs is, Steve's got, I think it was an 18 or 19... item list of things to do, and providing a templated style is one of those. I think we have to be very careful that if 600 MPs get 6,000 letters, all of which look identical except for the headed notepaper, I don't think it's going to work so well.
Yeah,
but it's a bit like you know, introductory paragraph, punchy point, bullet points of to why deterrence important to you specifically, and seek to tailor some of those letters as well. So, for example, if we know that an MP in Luton is particularly keen on the hospital in Luton and the parking incidents that happened there, make sure that we're tailoring that letter to that Luton MP that talks about the problems that beset that location and why enforcement is important.
And maybe, I guess, if you get someone from that, using the Luton example, if we could get the chief exec or the person who is in charge of parking for that particular hospital to join in and to send the letter as well. I guess that's another point that,
well,
getting the landowners involved.
It's exactly that. And so we'll also be templating landowner letters as well, so that operators can send a letter to their landowners, which gives a certain template to that, but not making that template so rigid that people copy and paste it across, because that's going to defeat the object. And of course, our hospital, the chief executive of a hospital, will have a different need to a retailer and to somebody who's managing residential spaces. All of them have got a similar or an identical importance, but they've got different needs from their parking management opportunity. So yeah, no, that would definitely be happening. The other thing is that where people have got letters that they want to send, they can send them to Steve, and Steve can give them some assistance. You know, give it a 5-minute review or whatever it might be, and say, well, actually, you've missed the obvious point here, which is this, or whatever it might be. Key point: no more than a single side of A4. MPs do not have the opportunity to read page after page after page. What we want to do is, when the minister goes into Parliament with the Act, where that Act is being debated following all the consultation and all the work, we want to make sure the minister, when he goes into Parliament to take questions from the 600 or so MPs, has on his single sheet of notes, his single sheet of A4 notes, which is all he'll go in with, a number of bullet points which we've provided for him, which really point out the importance of the things we want to put across. And I'll give you a really good example of that one, which hopefully will get people thinking about the sort of tangible examples that we need. We need them evidenced and tangible. So one of our operators looked at the compliance rate for those sites in his portfolio where the amount of the parking charge was £70. Where the enforcement amount was £70, there were the non-compliance with the terms and conditions was 40% higher than the entire estate. Now, that is a powerful bullet point to get on that single sheet of A4 for the MP to take into the House of Commons with him. And it's that sort of tangible stuff that's really important. We're looking to do likewise for residential locations as well. This was a set of retail style locations. Does that kind of make sense? It's that powerful message.
Yeah.
So more people will not comply if the enforcement amount is lower.
And maybe we could encourage sort of parking operators, you know, given at this time where the industry as a whole is generally not shut down, but there's not many parking charge notices being issued. Maybe this is the perfect time for people in the industry to start analysing their sites and looking at it at that level to see where is the highest level of compliance and where is the highest conversion rate, because it could be, you know, the higher the parking charge, the more people are complying with the rules. But then at the same time, the lower the charge, people might just think, oh, I'll take the risk. And, you know, the parking charge amount is so little, I'll just pay it if I get caught.
Absolutely. We will be working on that. We're working with people now on that very subject. That single piece of work that I mentioned there has been done. And I was working with one of our leading operators on that very fact myself. So yeah, and we'll be doing. I've had a conversation recently trying to do a similar thing for residential. It is very likely that at some point we will be doing a briefing webinar, okay, on this subject. We can't do that at the moment because we haven't had the initial meeting of the stakeholder group that's going to form this single code of practice. If everything hadn't happened in terms of COVID-19, what a massive if that is. If everything hadn't happened with COVID-19, we would have held that briefing meeting at ParkX in Coventry in June, because we'd have had the meetings in May. But now we don't know whether the meetings in May are going to take place or not, for perfectly valid reasons. But the moment we know what things look like, we can start preparing a briefing for members to enable them to consult on the things they're going to need to consult on.
And maybe once we've got sort of a clearer picture, we could get Steve onto the show, you know, however far down the line it is, you know, to do another episode on the code, but with a more informed picture and it being more, you know, this is what it's going to look like, this is what's going to happen, rather than it be sort of speculation and what would we like to see and what's our wish list.
I'm happy to come on your show anytime you want, without a
show. I meant the other Steve, the consultant Steve, who's working on the. You're more than welcome to join us as well. But
I get it. Yeah, yeah, I know.
He's
not that much better looking than me, I tell you. I think it's absolutely fine. I think that it'd be absolutely fine to get Steve onto something like this, and for Steve to answer the questions you're posing. I think we would need a bit more research before we're able to do that, because as you rightly say, at the moment, a lot of the answers I've had to give to the questions have been conjecture, my best guess, what I think will happen. I think we're very close to what we think will happen. We just have no guarantees. I've given the certainties. There are more and more uncertainties, many uncertainties than there are certainties. Hey, we'll narrow that down in the fullness of time. But yeah, I think Steve coming on to talk to you would be absolutely fine. More than happy to do that. And again, more than happy to take any questions that people who write to you in terms of the program wish to address to me. I think my email address is fairly well known. They can put that through and we'll answer those questions to the best of our abilities.
Excellent. And Steve, before we wrap up today's show, a question I have, what do you think can be done to improve the engagement from the smaller operators? Because I know that you have great engagement for the larger providers. However, those larger providers were once small providers. So what can we do to encourage the smaller companies to get more involved with the industry?
I actually think we do that pretty well in terms of quite a lot of the things we do. There are always those smaller operators who just don't want to engage. And some of the larger ones just don't want to engage with us. They don't attend ParkX.
Why do you think that is?
I think it's just I just don't think it's their style. You know, we have a free AOS conference every year. And it staggers me that, you know, just over half the membership are in the room. You know, absolutely staggering. There's no cost to it. I think that, you know, when I challenge people, they say, well, I haven't got the time, Steve. I've got a business to run, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's absolutely fine. But I'm more than happy to have them coming along. I think one of the interesting things that will come out of this COVID-19, though, is the fact actually we would be able to deliver some sessions virtually to people. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think that those are currently being explored. There's actually a webinar taking place right now at BPA Towers. BPA are putting out a webinar. I think there's 200 or 300 people taking part on that. I'm looking at how we can do that similar for the Private Parking Act and for other things. One of the options we've considered is looking at we do a couple of popular appeal workshops each year to help members. And of course, what we're doing is we ask people to come down to London for the day. We ask people or up to go to Manchester for the day. Poplar's based in Warrington, so we hold one there and one in London. That's great. But of course, you're asking operators to have a day out of the business. Where actually, if you want to do a 2-hour session on improving your popular appeal packs or a 2-hour session on an appeals workshop, we can do it virtually. This whole virtual thing, this whole use of Zoom and webinars has really opened my eyes to what's going on. The other thing we're considering introducing, I'd say it's beyond considering, we are going to look to do this very shortly, is to try and get a sort of AOS operator community platform within the BPA website. So where AOS operators can come and talk freely amongst themselves and know that there won't be anybody else listening in. Obviously, the challenge there, of course, is I'll be there from time to time, so they'll have to be careful. But in all the sincerity, what's in my head is I would probably arrange to be on there for a couple of hours each week or an hour for a couple of days each week, where people can come onto that platform and ask specific questions from that point of view. We're not, you know, so we're trying to arrange those virtual platforms. The other thing is, operators are more than happy. I'm more than happy for operators to contact me. And as I said at the start of the conversation, probably about 50% I've actually been in good dialogue with in the month of April. And that will continue. I would expect them to be back in May and June. And particularly having spoken, there'll be people I haven't spoken to before, because they're not that so big that they have to be on my radar in terms of demanding of my time, but they're also not a problem. So I'm not on my radar from a negative point of view. But actually, yeah, I gave one chap a bit of a shock, actually, because he dropped me a question on an email and I just wrote him back and said, can we talk about this? And he went, well, I wasn't expecting you to want to talk. And I said, well, if you've seen my typing, you'll understand why we're going to talk about it. And obviously we had a far-reaching conversation about lots of other things, because if you just answer an email, you'll only answer the question. If you have a conversation, you'll talk about other things and things come to mind. And actually, in that conversation, he had a problem at the start of the call. He had three problems at the end of it. He thought of two more things he wanted to ask me. Okay. Two of those are on the way to being resolved. Third one will take a bit longer. That's what we're here to do. And that is a smaller operator. It was a band one operator. The operator who was the best at Poplar last year was a band one operator. Yeah. I think the challenge is, though, where you've got a band one operator, very often they are the business. They are the person issuing the tickets and doing the notice processing. So I can understand the engagement issues. But we're not close to it. We'll always try and engage in whatever way, shape or form people want.
And I'm not just talking from my personal experience whereby, you know, I've been involved in the industry for some time. For me personally, it's because sometimes I'm not necessarily that engaged with the speakers that are there and, you know, the topics that have been discussed. So I was just wondering, from your point of view, how can we make parking sexier? How can we make it more engaging? And you see younger, Alistair and others from Just Park, for example, you have a younger crowd coming in. So how do we get them actively engaged and make parking more exciting?
I think first and foremost, making parking exciting is quite an interesting one, because basically, you know, I tell people over dinner that I'm in parking, and they think actually I've got a hat on with a yellow band around it and a pad of tickets, and I have to put them right on that. I think it's always a challenge to engage. I put the agenda together for the AOS conference recently, and I deliberately wanted to do things which I felt were pertinent on that day. So we spent a lot of time on the Parking Code of Practice Act, without a shadow of doubt. Okay. We also spent a lot of time in trying to get some of the legal aspects coming through. So we had a brief GDPR resume. We also talked about litigation as well. We had Sally Gunnell as our keynote speaker, and I wanted to deliver there a bit of an uplift to people in terms of pushing them forwards. I think in terms of actually bringing a more vibrancy to the membership engagement that we do is actually, as I said, having those standard conferences for the people who've always liked to go to conference and network and, you know, whatever it might be, which is a fantastic thing to do, for people to catch up with friends, to have the conversations they want to have. It's brilliant. But actually, my eyes have been open with this opportunity for virtual meetings. You know, I spend most of my day on Teams or Zoom, which is great. You know, I think I've had two Teams meetings today, a phone conference, and now this. Marvellous. You know, I've got to be honest with you, back in the day, we probably would have travelled for some of those meetings, and I'd spent half my life on the train. And also, you can't reach as many people. So actually, yeah, this COVID-19 tragedy that it is will have some benefits. I think it will teach us a lot of things. I am a lot more productive than I ever would have been by going into the office. It doesn't mean I'm never going to go to the office again, because you need interaction with your people, with your teams. You need to have, you know, eyeball to eyeball conversations, appraisals, whatever meetings it might be, because everyone needs that sort of thing. But by the same token, it's about productivity and what you get in terms of the results that come out of something. And that would do that. I absolutely see the embracing of technology as being the way ahead coming out of this. And that's from me, who, quite frankly, I'm a bit of a Luddite, right? So, but I'm on an upward learning curve with this, and I will continue to do that. I don't really understand how the things work, but I do understand the messages of where it's important. So the ability to spend time individually with somebody in the way that we are now is really important. The ability for this then to be shared with other people further down the track to spark further debate, even if that's a one-on-one conversation in some way, shape or form, or a question on an email, or whatever people want, however people want to be having a discussion with, it's just opened up a new communication channel for us, and that is so incredibly positive.
And just throw in a suggestion out there, you know, maybe with the AOS conference, another one back in February, maybe you could even live stream it as well at the same time. So if there are particular seminars people want to listen to, they could watch it from their office, because you know you've got some operators that are down in Exeter, which getting to Birmingham is quite a task. You know, it could even involve an overnight stay. You've run the risk of people not showing up because they can just watch what they want online, but then you don't get the networking side of things and a day out of the office to sort of meet new people and catch up with other people. So just throwing the suggestion out there.
Yeah, I think that yes. I think live streaming of certain things can be definitely on the cards there, because all of a sudden the world has changed from that point of view. I think we do have to be a little bit careful in that where in the room everyone's together and everyone knows everyone's there, the actual members of the audience are able to ask the questions with comfort that they want to ask. But there are ways around that. And we've been using this, is it Slido, the question answering?
Yeah, because at the conference you did it from your phone. You had to go on the website
And I think,
and it come up on the TV.
And I think that's a fantastic, for me, it's a fantastic addition to our portfolio. And I think the worry that I had about live streaming in terms of controlling the questions, I think Slido enables us just to make sure that if there is an inappropriate question asked, it's not actually posed, and therefore it's not live streamed. If I'm honest with you, we've had very, very limited experience of inappropriate questions, but you just have to be ready for it just in case. Mm. I think we've had two conferences with Slido now, and it's certainly better than getting people to put their hands up, I can tell you. When you're at the front doing that job, the compare bit, it is infinitely better, because you can actually work out where you're going to direct the questions. Or if you fancy answering it yourself, which I did on a couple of occasions where I felt it needed to be done.
It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show.
Yeah, well, I've enjoyed it too. Been brilliant. Thank you very much, guys.
And before we wrap this up, I understand the BPF just launched a podcast as well. Do you want to use it as an opportunity to plug it?
Absolutely. I think we're launching all sorts of things. I think the thing to understand with the launches is we're starting off with a more pan membership thing, so it's a BPA wide spectrum stuff, and then as we get feedback from people, we're going to then look at narrowing down some of the subject areas. So we've got a big audience for a big podcast, but ultimately we will probably reduce down to some more focused ones depending on what on the demand from members, if that makes sense. So that's the plan. So at the moment it's sort of like everything for everybody, but that will soon reduce down to some more detail stuff. So private parking being one, local authority stuff being another, meeting the needs of our enforcement agent members, meeting the needs of the people involved in structures and asset management, meeting the needs of the people who manufacture the equipment. All of which is really, really important separately, because there will be people who, from the private parking operators, who probably wouldn't want to go and listen to people from local authorities and vice versa. And people involved in the enforcement agent side of things probably aren't that interested in how a payment machine is put together. Separately, though, there will be people who are interested in all of those things. And we're going to try and get it demand led to put those on. So I would, in terms of a shameless plug for those, look out for them. But the bigger plug is, if you believe we should be doing something, drop me a note and we'll find a way of delivering it.
Excellent.
Perfect. Steve, thank you very much. And again, thank you for your time.
My pleasure, guys. Brilliant.
And that's it for another episode of Break the Mould, the parking podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show. If you did, tell a friend, tell a colleague, pass the pod. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time with another special guest. So until then, thank you for listening as we break the mold.